So tonight, my talk is entitled "The Problems of Comparing," and I want to start just by reading this verse. This is from the Samyutta Naya, 22:49, and I'm going to keep referring back to this all through the evening. When anyone, on the basis of form, which is impermanent, suffering and subject to change, regards themselves thus, I am superior, or I am inferior, or I'm equal. What does that do to apart from not seeing things as they really are? In the next part of this sutta, the Buddha goes through the other four aggregates as well, and repeats exactly the same language. So this is one of those teachings on the five aggregates. But just this all by itself. So when you're reading, you'll often see the word conceit in the sutta. That's another word for comparing. So you'll often see he's reached a place where he no longer experiences conceit. Other translations that you see in other places might be something like pride or arrogance or even measuring. It's considered one of the latent torments, which means it's something that's sort of hidden. We don't normally see it. In this case, comparing, it's hard to see because it seems so natural. Well, of course, I compare myself to other people, or I compare some one person to another person. And basically, there are three modes, three valences that comparing takes. I'm better than, I'm worse than, I'm equal to. And I want to read something from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness, here. And he's talking about restlessness, one of the five kilesas. This is very relevant to we've all been here, I'm sure, probably many times. Sometimes we worry about our practice. While goals and aspirations are key moments in our spiritual journey, the mind can easily be over concerned about our progress, but about how we think we're doing, obsessing about our enlightenment or lack of it. With this kind of worry, it's very easy to fall into self-judgment, a certain kind of spiritual self-absorption. We start comparing ourselves to other meditators, the length of our sits, the amount of food we take, how slow we're moving, and our minds can easily be agitated by this worry about our practice. We lose the simplicity of easeful resting in the moment, mindful of whatever is arising. So, actually, Joseph tells this great story about one of his very first retreats with Goenka. The men's dorm had these little sort of cubicles where they were just like cloth partitions on three sides. So you had a space where you was your space and a light to read and very basic. And he was really keen and he was determined that he was going to be serious and he was going to be the most serious person there. He was going to really tell everybody. And every night he'd about three sections down from where he was, there was another guy who also had his light on late at night. And no matter what Joseph did, no matter how hard he tried, eventually he'd fall asleep and turn on his light. And so at the end of the retreat, he's like, this whole retreat, he's comparing himself to this guy. And this guy is more used to me. He stays up later studying than I do, or practicing. And so at the end of the retreat, he happens to be talking to this guy, and Joseph tells him, And the guy just laughs. He says, "Oh no, I was asleep with my light on." Right? This is where comparing gets us. If we're not careful, like we're comparing ourselves to something that's totally illusory anyway. It's an interesting problem. Okay, but let's look at the idea of these three valences and take a closer look at all three of them. So the first one is better than. I'm better than X, right? So this is where we think that we're better than some particular person or some group or class of people. And this always creates a sense of separation. Me, not me. I'm better than them. You know, I'm better than those people who voted for Trump. How many times have I been there, right? And I'm sure people who voted for Trump think I'm better than those people who didn't vote for Trump. I mean, it goes both ways, right? I'm better than those people who don't meditate. I'm a meditator. I'm really good. Yeah. This is why often comparing is called conceit. This is where the word conceit really becomes quite obvious. This is a big problem. This is something the Dalai Lama had to say about this. When I meet someone, the Dalai Lama said, I always try to relate to the person on some basic human level. On that level, I know that just like me, he or she wishes to find happiness, to have fewer problems and less difficulty in their life. Whether I am speaking with one person or whether I'm giving a talk to a large group of people, I always see myself first and foremost as just a fellow human. That way, there is no need for introduction. If, on the other hand, I relate to others from the perspective of myself as being someone different, a Buddhist, a Tibetan, and so on, I will then create walls to keep me apart from others. And if I relate to others thinking that I'm the Dalai Lama, I will create the basis for my own separation and loneliness. After all, there's only one Dalai Lama in the entire world. In contrast, if I see myself primarily in terms of myself as a fellow human, I will then have more than 7 billion people who I can feel deep connection with. And this is wonderful, isn't it? What do we need to fear or worry about when we have 7 billion other people who are just like you? It's just a different perspective. Instead of comparing, seeing how the connection we all have. This is and so basically our sense of this sense of separation we create is a way to sort of create our own suffering. A friend of mine told this story to me a while back. She was, I guess this was back at one of the two elections that Trump was involved in. I forget which one. I think it was the first one, actually. And she had gone to Denver the night evening of the election, like after everybody had voted and they were counting votes, and she'd gone to hang out with a friend in Denver, and she was going to meet this person or these people, but she was early, and so she went to this bar and was just sort of quietly having a drink before she met her friends, and this woman came up to her and said, you're one of those people who, you know, didn't vote for Trump, aren't you?" Like, she was like kind of belligerent, right? And my friend, she's very sort of sweet, and she didn't want to engage and didn't want to go there. And this woman just sort of kept at her and kept at her and kept at her. And finally, she sort of turned to the woman and said, "Yeah, I'm one of those people, and I'm here to meet my two lesbian friends." It's like a "so there," you know? And afterwards, because she realized she'd got caught in comparing herself to this woman, like this one was like one of those horrible people, and, you know, telling her that would really get her. And since this, my friend was just like so distraught about what she'd done. She felt like she'd betrayed her friends, she'd betrayed herself, and all she'd created all this suffering just because she got caught in this comparison with this other person. Like she was so different from this horrible person, and she got caught by it and reacted to it. And this way of thinking also, when you think about it in the context of the Brahma Viharas, sometimes this is where we get led to what are called the near enemies. For instance, compassion becomes pity. It's like, oh, those poor people who aren't like me. Pity always separates us from others. It's always a comparison going on when we have that energy of pity. And equanimity becomes indifference. It's like those other people, they're not important. Once again, it's an act of comparing that separates you. They're not important. They're not like as the Dalai Lama described his relationship when he thought about other people. So that's better than, and that's is this it's this habit, these mind habits we have that we get caught in over and over again. I have to really watch this when I'm reading the New York Times, because this is when I always get caught in my better than thoughts. Just because it's like, oh, look at that, great, that person doing that or saying that, or I have to, oh no, don't go there. And there's worse than, this is the flip side, right? This is thinking we're worse than someone else. This is how we constantly beat ourselves up. I'm not as good. I'm not as serious a meditator as my friend George or whatever. Or I'm not as good a painter as, whatever it is. I mean, you're always comparing and comparing and comparing, and I'm not good enough. And this is also this is where doubt, one of the kleshas, arises all the time. When we're caught in comparing and thinking we're worse than others, then we start to doubt our practice. We start to doubt that I'm not good enough to do this. I can't do this. I'm not pure enough. I'm not holy enough. Whatever. I'm not enough. Whatever that enough is. I'm not like those other people who seem to just succeed effortlessly. I'm not like that guy three people down who always has their light on. It's just and lasts longer than me, right? We just get caught there. And doubt is the thing more than anything else that will hold us back from deepening our practice. So we really create our own suffering when we get caught in this comparison of I'm not good enough, they're better than me, whatever. This is and it's often related to the other near enemy, wanting, which is the near enemy of metta. We want to be better, to see ourselves better than we think we are. It's a want. It's I gotta have it. I should be better. What's wrong? That's lack of loving kindness towards yourself. Caught in wanting. We can't accept ourselves just as we are in this moment. It's like, no, I should be better than this. I'm not saying you shouldn't try and do well, but you just don't want to get caught in this beating yourself up. This is related to a whole. I'm a big bookstore guy. It's a whole section in every bookstore you ever go into these days that has what are called self-help books. Books that, you'll read this book and it'll solve all your problems and you'll be perfect and happy and wonderful and blah 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 blah. And I just downloaded, this is a while back, the top 10 self-help books on Amazon. And I just thought I'd share these titles. Just, Healing Your Emotional Self, a powerful program to help you raise your self-esteem, quiet your inner critic, and overcome your shame. Doesn't it make you just want to read that and it'll solve all your problems? Yeah. When am I going to be happy? How to break the emotional bad habits that make you miserable. Here's one of my favorites. Change your life and everyone in it. That's a good one. I'm going to change, not only am I going to change my life, I'm going to change everything. Yeah. The 10 best ever anxiety management techniques. The Single Sassy Woman's Survival Guide, Letting Go and Moving On. The universe doesn't give a flying beep about you. That one's really, I think it's a, probably more accurate than a lot of them, actually. But it's like that's that whole that industry is so powerful in our culture because we're taught we're not good enough. And so now we have this huge industry of books that tell us how to be good enough. And you see people with shelves of these books. Like they read one and they read another and they're always looking for the right book, the perfect book, right? The perfect method. Instead of just let's maybe I'll stop comparing myself to every other people who obviously everyone else is really happy except me. I mean, that's quite clear. Then we have equal to. And at first, when I first encountered this, I went, oh, what's the problem with equal to? It's like that's sort of like the American thing, right? It's like all men are created equal. Sort of built into the national identity. I mean, ignoring the fact that when that statement was made, it meant white men who owned property. But it was and it was just men. It had nothing to do with women. It was like and today, it's not that isn't upheld, that ideal isn't really upheld very well. Then there's this whole story, and which is also quite predominant, where somehow or other we should all pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps. This was a really predominant theme story in my life for a long time. I grew up in a very working class, blue collar family. I worked my way through college because my parents didn't have any money to send me there. And I was like, I'm one of those good blue collar boys that's made it. It was like that was my whole vibe. And I sort of judged others by that in some sense. But it was also like, I'm equal to anybody. I'm just as good as anybody because I've done it on my own, right? It's so easy to think that way. It's like if we're all equal, right? So if I can do this, everyone else can. If I can be pull myself up by my bootstraps, then anybody should be able to, because I was just working class boy, right? But this is really a not true and a very sort of dangerous thought pattern in our culture. I'm born white and male. And I turned out quite tall, right? 6 foot 4. These are huge advantages. I'm straight. I'm lucky enough to have grown up in a loving two-parent family. I had every advantage you could imagine. That good, and basically the phrase I came across is, "I was born on third base, but I th keep thinking I got there because I hit a triple. I was just born there." Other people, to get the third base is their whole life might they may never get to third base, and I was born there. So, yeah, we're all equal, that. That equal myth is a way of denying how fortunate I'm and how disadvantaged us are. It's a way, it's once again, it's like it's an illusion. It's a delusional thinking. It's delusional thinking. And it's sort of comforting to think, that, oh, we're all in the same boat. There's another classic phrase, we're all in the same boat. We're all in the same boat. But actually, some of us have yachts and some of us get leaky dinghies. So yeah, we all have boats, but some of them are way better to start with, and some just don't work that well. The other problem with all three of these modes is that all of them are ways where we create a sense of a separate self. That's called conceit. The conceit is this illusion that somehow we're separate. That's the main conceit. That because every one of these is I'm comparing myself to them. Me, not me. So even in equal to, which it sounds sort of benevolent, though it isn't, as I've hopefully explained. It's like it's still we're caught in this world of duality, me, not me. I'm equal to them. They're equal to me. There's them and me. So and that's why, that's why the Buddha says here, I think, what is due to apart from not seeing things as they really are, by which he means that we're not separate at all. That's how things really are. That there's this sense of a separate self that I keep reinforcing by thinking in these forms. It's just self-perpetuating my suffering and the suffering of others over and over and over again. But it's so common. Because it seems natural, like, well, of course, everybody compares themselves to other people. Well, why wouldn't I want to do that? Well, it's easy to get caught in that idea that, well, it's okay. Another thing from the sutta. And this is the Buddha explaining how we get caught in thinking self. This is another discourse. This is called the Greater Discourse on the Full Moon Night from the Majjhima Nikaya. Bhikkhus, what do you think? Is material form permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Venerable Sir. Is what is impermanent suffering or happiness? Suffering, Venerable Sir. If what is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change, fit to be regarded thus. This is mine, this I am, this is myself. No, Venerable Sir. And then he basically goes through the other four aggregates, right? Then here's his conclusion. Therefore, bhikkhus, any kind of material form, whatever, whether past, future, or present, all material form should be seen as it actually is with the proper wisdom. This is not mine. I am not this. This is not myself. And once again, he runs through the other four aggregates. Notice he's saying it in three different ways to make sure we understand. Right? This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. It's through the teachings on the aggregates is where the Buddha over and over again is trying to make it clear that we cling to these aggregates, and that's what creates our sense of a separate self. Then the Buddha says, seeing thus, a well-taught noble disciple becomes disenchanted with the material form, disenchanted with feeling tone, disenchanted with perception, disenchanted with formations, disenchanted with consciousness. I love the word here, disenchanted. Like, we're enchanted by these things. They're like there's some sort of like magic thing happens that we just get caught in believing that they somehow are ours. That they create, this is how we create our sense of self, by believing these things are ours. It's an enchantment. You know, like some sort of magic almost, right? So, and he's saying, seeing thus, a well-taught noble disciple becomes disenchanted. We break that enchantment. Being disenchanted, he becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, his mind is liberated. When he is liberated, there comes the knowledge. It is liberated. He understands. Birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There's no more coming to any state of being. Sounds pretty good to me, anyhow. But what he's pointing out here is all of this arises, so much of this arises out of comparing. Yeah, and this thing about the sense of self, the Buddha comes at this from the five aggregates. He also comes at it from the teachings on the six sense bases. You know, because you look at the six sense bases, and when you really look at them, you see, well, there's no self there. There's just stuff happening. You know, and what are called the four elements, which is yet another teaching he uses to sort of. I mean, all of these teachings are doing the same thing. It's like, let's take everything that we can imagine, everything we can experience, and put them into categories and see if there's anything, any self in any of those things. And we keep coming up with the same answer. Nope. No self there. That's how the Buddha taught this. He couldn't teach it directly. He could only teach it in his, using these indirect ways, because it's like, he can say, oh, there's no self. End of discussion. Well, that doesn't work. We have to somehow come to some intuitive feeling about it. So it's interesting to also look at what are the sources for this mental habit of comparing. What are the things, what are the patterns we get caught in? What encourages us to fall into one of those patterns? And classically, there are four that we have to think about: birth, wisdom, wealth, and appearance. So when the Buddha talked about birth, he was talking about the caste system that existed in India in his day, where you were born a Brahmin, or you were born into one of these other castes. It's the luck of the draw, right? But that's who you were. That defined who you were. And if you were a Brahmin, you were better than everybody else. And if you were an untouchable, you were worse than everybody else. And then there's all these castes and subs and layers. But it was all, the whole caste system in India was about comparing. It's about who gets to be in charge, and who gets to lead the prayers, and who gets to be a warrior, and who gets to, you know, make pots, and who has to clean the latrines. It was a very, quite a rigid system. So, but what does that have to do with us? Well, though there isn't a quote caste system in our country, or in our culture, there certainly is energy around that, vibes around that. How about I'm better because I was born in America. How often are we told that? Yeah. I'm not an immigrant, not one of those immigrants. I was born here. Makes me better. It's a major problem in our culture these days. Or I'm better because I'm an American, and America is the best country in the world. Often do we hear that? I mean, the fact that statistics show that it's far from the best country in the world, it like ranks 20th in education and way low down in terms of infant mortality and all. I mean, there's huge. If you start looking at statistics, country's nowhere near the best country in the world by like a long, long shot. But that's the narrative that we're fed over and over again, and that people grab onto. And this causes all kinds of suffering because we believe that America is the best country in the world. Then we see what's going on, and we go, ooh, how could I believe that? And how could this be happening in my country, which is the best country in the world? More suffering. And also, I mean, some of this suffering also comes from we don't understand. Because we're natives and we live here and we're everything. I'm a Canadian, but the Canadians and Americans pretty much the same thing anyway. So, relatively speaking, in the world, I probably, if some of my Canadian friends will hear me say that, they'll cringe, but that's okay. It's like we just don't understand how difficult it is for people who aren't fortunate enough to have citizenship in this country and be a native, how difficult it is to go through that immigrant experience, or to even more difficult, be an illegal immigrant in this country, which is extremely difficult thing to have to live through and deal with on a day-to-day basis. Because it just basically, if you're a legal immigrant, you're always worried and you're always afraid. That's not my experience in life, let me tell you, and I'm sure it isn't any of yours either. How it is, but we compare ourselves and we think we're better because we don't have to, we're not caught in that world, or if we're careful, we do anyway. So that's one of the four. Then there's wisdom. This is a good one. We feel that if we're better educated, whatever that means, then we are better in general than those other people. All those ignorant people who never went to college. What's wrong with them? Blah, 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 blah. Right? Another thing that people get caught in all the time. How about we feel that because we know the Dhamma, we're better than those other people who don't know the Dhamma? We have the real wisdom. And it could be the Dhamma, it could be the Bible, it could be, take your pick of something that people cling to on that sort of level. And it's like, that's how I compare myself, because I'm wiser. But then the flip side of that is that people can also think that those highly educated people are really snobbish. They think they're the elite, but those the East and West Coast elites, but us real Americans, we live here in the heart of the country. And yeah, that's the flip side of that. So it goes in both directions. They aren't like me, those elite, those snobbish, educated elite people. I'm just a regular working guy, right? The elite don't understand what it is to be a real American. This is what's going on in our country all the time. And it's this is comparing based on it's just on wisdom, or on perceived wisdom at least. Sometimes I think wisdom has almost nothing to do with a college education anyway, but that's a separate discussion. Then there's wealth. This is a place where we often get caught comparing. Richer is better, or richer is worse, because those rich people are so greedy. Poor is bad. That person must be really lazy, because if they're poor, it must be because they're so lazy. Well, I talked about proud of my working class roots. Makes me feel more better and real somehow, right? We are totally unconscious most of the time of how privileged we are just to live in this country, to live in this country and this culture, compared to most of the world. We are just immensely privileged. And we just take it for granted. We don't even think about it. It's not something that we contemplate at all. It's just, well, that's the way it is. But, and here's another interesting little aspect. There's poor people in Boulder. Right here in Boulder, there's lots of poor people. Most of the time, you don't even see them. We're so in our little Boulder bubble of everyone's, hip and high tech and wonderful and all that sort of stuff. You don't see. I've spent some time doing hospice work and going into some of the places where people who don't have any money end up, they're dying. These are grim. Right here in Boulder. There's a couple of really grim places these people end up in that just compared to, say, Golden West and some of the sort of the cheap expensive places, these places are like, I can remember going to sit with this guy who was dying. He was indigent. He was dying of cirrhosis. He'd been an alcoholic all his life. And I went to sit with him because that's what we did is in the hospice world. There wasn't even a chair in his room. They didn't have enough chairs for all the rooms in this place. I had to sit on the floor just to sit with him. That's what goes on in this right here in Boulder, let alone what goes on in the rest of the world. But we're just totally blithely unaware of it. And, I even when I was there with that guy, I thought, well, this guy drank himself into, like I got caught in comparing. And there I was trying to just be there with him. I could feel that comparing energy going on in me of like this guy brought himself to this by just drinking himself into the ground, literally. He had nothing. He had nothing, any resources at all. Okay. Then the final of these four is the prince. This is a really interesting one. Think of how often in our culture we get caught in thinking about the norms of physical beauty, right? Young, fit, blonde, tall. These are what beautiful, healthy, wonderful people are. And if you're not one of those things, then there's something wrong with you. Because you should be able to be, healthy and fit, and you should somehow be able to stay young forever. mean, that's what our culture teaches us over and over and over again, that you should be able to just keep, 60s the new 40 stories and stuff like, or things like that. It's like somehow or other we should be able to just look young and healthy and all the time. We compare ourselves to standard all the time. Then there's the whole thing of clothes. As you know, I'm not much of a what call a clothes horse. Here I am. I put on clean jeans today. It was the big event, But it was like our culture is so obsessed with clothing and its physical appearance. If you have the right thing, there's now this thing called quick fashion where things are made really fast, but they only last for a couple and then they fall apart. And people buy them because they're the latest hip thing. And ecologically, it's a total disaster, of course, but it's really, let alone, things like designer labels. Where I remember once I went into the store, I was just looking for a pair of jeans, and I didn't know a fancy designer place. I just saw some jeans in the window and I went in, and they were like designer jeans. I forget who the designer. This pair of jeans was like $200 or something like that. And I was like, this is a long time ago. Lord knows what they're worth now. And I was like, huh? I can get jeans for $25 at Men's Work Warehouse or someplace, but I happened to just see this store and I remembered I needed some jeans. And I was like, they look like regular jeans to me. I mean, I maybe they were like, they were stitched together a little better or something, but who knows? Then there's all the things about appearance that do that have to do with people who dress differently for cultural or religious reasons. Hijab being the classic example in our culture right now. But so the ultra-Orthodox Jews, how, I mean, I can remember reacting when I first encountered ultra-Orthodox Jewish men in their black things with those funny hats and those long earlocks, and it's like, oh my God, they're so weird. That was just my reaction to them. And it was just like I was just caught in comparing. It's all it was. I was just comparing myself to them. And they were weird and I was normal. Just because they look different. And we go to that place all the time too. The whole issue of beliefs around butch looking women and swishy looking as a way to judge people and compare. It's so common in culture. How basically my working class roots are showing there because that's how I grew up. Those were like bedrock beliefs. That was how things were. You had to, this those people were weird. So these are all things we do. We compare ourselves to others based on birth, where we were born, how wisdom, wealth, appearance. This is how we fall into this mode of comparing over and over and over again. And every time we do that, we create a sense of a separate self. Because there's automatically there's a me, not me going on. Want to read something from Joseph Goldstein here. He's talking about, this is from a chapter in this book called Insight Meditation called Conceit and the Compare Mind. The antidote to conceit is to drop right back into mindfulness and to focus on the momentariness of phenomena. When our mind is caught in comparison, it is caught in a perception of self and somebody else. We are enmesh ourselves in that hallucinatory conceptual frame of self and other. We make such comparisons when we do not see how everything, including the very thought of self and other, is ceaselessly arising and passing away. The contents of these thoughts trap us because we fail to see the impermanence of the thoughts themselves. There's the next layer, right? We fail to see the impermanence of the thoughts themselves. Comparing mind disappears when we succeed in seeing it. So what's basically Joseph is saying is, well, what's the solution to conceit? Oh, mindfulness. What a surprise. It's like this is the solution. It's like we have to be mindful all the time when we're interacting with others or just thinking about others and see how often we get caught in conceit, in comparing ourselves to others, better than, worse than, equal to, over any of these issues that I talked about. Mindfulness is the key that'll sort of help us gradually fall out of that to get to where the Dalai Lama described himself as, I'm just one of these 7 billion people, and that's all I am. I'm not separate from anybody. That's comparing more than anything else that creates our sense of a separate self. So it's like if we can practice, set the intention to be very mindful of seeing comparing mind when it arises, it's a way to work on shifting away from that constantly recreating self over and over and over again with these patterns of thought. Of course, I have a poem about this as well. This is another Dana Fald's book. I don't read from this as often. It's called One Soul. And it was sort of the follow-on from her original book I read from so much. But this is called Self-Observation Without Judgment, which is, I guess, what I've been talking about for the last 45 minutes or so. Self-Observation Without Judgment. Release the harsh and pointed inner voice. It's just throwback to the past and holds no truth about this moment. Let go of self-judgment, the old learned ways of beating yourself up for each imagined inadequacy. Allow the dialogue within the mind to grow friendlier and quiet. Shift out of inner criticism and life suddenly looks very different. I can say this only because I make the choice 100 times a day to release the voice that refuses to acknowledge the real me. What's needed here isn't more prodding towards perfection, but intimacy, seeing clearly and embracing what I see. Love, not judgment, sows the seeds of tranquility and change. Wonderful advice, as far as I'm concerned. In fact, love, not judgment, sows the seeds of tranquility and change.